The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
Why did Bev Parsons think he could get away with robbing a small town bank in North Dakota?
Because he was very improvident and didn't have a sense of the consequence to his own actions.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Richard Ford about his latest novel, a book titled Canada.
The narrator of Canada is Del Parsons, and at the beginning of the story, he and his twin sister Berner live with their parents, Bev and Neva, in Great Falls, Montana. So explain what's going on with these people, with this family, in the spring and summer of 1960.
In the summer of 1960, Bev decides he needs to leave the Air Force, having been in the Air Force since before it was the Air Force, when it was the Army Air Corps in the late 30s, and was a bombardier in the Second World War and was awarded combat ribbons for it. And he hasn't been successful in the Air Force. And after having been in for 20 years, when it's just in 1960, he decides, because he's been demoted in rank, that he doesn't need to be in the Air Force anymore. That what he needs to do, it's the turning of the decade, he needs to get out into the world and make a living and make a success of himself, because he can see around him that other people are making successes of life. And he's optimistic and feels that he can make a success too.
And his children are just about to start high school in Great Falls.
That's right.
And they are kind of in a holding pattern until he gets himself figured out.
Well, it's the summer of 1960, and school hasn't started yet. And during that summer, when he detaches from the Air Force at the Air Force Base in Great Falls, they are in the same holding pattern that kids are in every summer, in a way. But they are, particularly in Dell's case, eager to start school, eager to get going. Dell likes school. His sister, Berner, is, I guess you would say, indifferent to school. She has a wilder streak and probably wants to follow that wilder streak to the West Coast, which inevitably, I think it's inevitably anyway, she does.
And Bev's wife, Neva, doesn't seem very well suited for living in Great Falls, Montana.
Well, she doesn't feel she's well suited, and that, I guess, makes her not be well suited. She's Jewish and comes from an immigrant family who have left Eastern Europe a long time ago and moved to Tacoma, Washington. And she's educated. She's a teacher. She is the mother of two children whom she loves and wants to take care of and see succeed. And she's been traipsing around the country with her sort of flyboy husband from Alabama for a long time, and has just about, when this book commences, she's just about had her fill of it.
Yeah, they didn't seem like they were very well matched.
That's Dell's view, anyway, that they're not well matched. Dell tries to understand the calamity of their life, robbing a bank, as being a consequence of their being not well matched. I don't know. I mean, there's a line that the book relies on quite a lot, which is a line of Ruskin's. And the line is, composition is the joining of unequal things, and marriage is always the joining of unequal things, it seems to me. Most people aren't well matched because they come from different quadrants of life, and marriage somehow allows them the accommodative opportunity to match. And these two, at least in my view, even while they may not match, they love each other. He's not giving her what she needs at this stage of her life. She's 36 years old. So rather than think that they don't match, which is Dell's view, I think that they love each other, but they've just decided that they want different things. To say that they aren't well matched is, for me, a child's conventional wisdom to try to account for something which will otherwise be without a count.
Trying to figure out why his mother would agree to help his father rob a bank.
Yes, yes. That was the novelist's problem. How can I get these two people to do something that I want them to do when all good sense commands that they not? And so that was one of, you know, it's every novelist's problem. How can I get my characters to do what I want them to do in a way that seems plausible to the reader? But I have a theory, and I guess you could call it a theory, that fiction works very well often when the implausible is made plausible. Because it happens in our lives all the time, that implausible things happen and we find rationales for them, or we do implausible things and then find plausibility for them after the fact. Fiction draws a kind of a torque from those implausible things being made plausible. And it reverts to the Ruskin line of composition being the arrangement of unequal things.
Well, I mean, you come up with a pretty good reason why she might go along with the bank robbery, and I won't give away the plot enough to say what that reason is, but he understands, I think, a little bit more about why his father would do something like this.
His father is kind of a pop-off in a way. He's a guy who's prideful and somewhat insecure, but he also has sort of a romanticism about robbing banks. He has sort of a Bonnie and Clyde fascination, and he treats his son to this fascination at a point in the book. And so when the son is trying to figure out why indeed his father would rob a bank in Creekmore, North Dakota, that's one of the things the son does is rely on, that his father had once taken him to a movie, and outside the movie house, they had organizers drawn up this car that they called the Bonnie and Clyde car, which was all full of holes. And his father said to him, "Would you ever like to rob a bank?" And Dell says, "Well, no, really," because Dell's rather a conventional little boy. And father says, "Well, I kind of would, I think." So I think that's one of the rationales that Dell uses.
There's also the aspect of his father's personality that he has served in the Air Force, and he thinks that it's okay for him to rob the bank because the government will give the people back their money with the insurance, and also that maybe he is owed this because he has served in the military.
The bottom line to that set of rationales is that he believes, and maybe the author believes as well, that Bev has been in the military basically all of his adult life and has always been taken care of, has never really had to live out in the world with the rest of people, has always lived on basis, has always had his everything provided, and so is not really savvy about the world, so that he could have this kind of fly-by-night idea. So he could have this screwy rationale about deserving from the government in view of his service the money that he would take from the bank because, as he believes, that the FDIC will give it all back. What I was trying to think about why people would rob a bank, and the novel uses this line as a refrain, A, people do rob banks and they do it all the time. And for the most part, when people rob banks, they almost immediately get caught. And before they get caught, they're acting on the screwiest possible reasons in the world, totally implausible reasons. Not just that they won't get caught, but more importantly, that they must do it. It never makes any sense, really. Even for the most hardened and skillful of criminals, I think, to rob a bank, because you're by and large not going to get away with it.
Yeah, there's this myth floating around in our culture that robbing a bank will give you the money you need to make something better.
All you want's just one little change in luck, and then you'll never do it again.
Right. Well, a lot happens to Dell within a short period of time. His parents rob a bank. Later, there are murders, arrest. He's forced to move to Canada. There's some nefarious goose hunting escapades going on, and all because of bad choices made by his parents. why doesn't he just run away, take charge of his own life like his sister
because
does?
The author didn't want him to.
I see.
And it never occurred to me that he would do that. And it never occurred to me that that he would do what his sister did or take charge of his life. I mean, I think if I had the notion that he might have that as a choice, I would have accounted for it. I would have done that trick that novelists do, which is that when I have a problem of plausibility, such as the question that you just asked, why wouldn't he go away? Why wouldn't he run away? I then turn that particular line of logic back in on Dell and have Dell ask that question of himself. Why am I not running away? What is it about me that causes me not to run away? And then I'll provide the answer for that and I'll go on and have him do what I want him to do.
Well, one thing that he really wants to do, which is maybe why he stays put, is that he wants to go to school. And there's a passage in chapter 2 I'd like you to read that will tell us a little bit more about what motivates him.
Still, at least at the beginning, I liked Great Falls. It was called the Electric City because the falls produced power. It seemed rough-edged and upright, though remote, yet still was a part of the limitless country we'd already lived in. I didn't much like it that the streets only had numbers for names, which was confusing, and my mother said that it was a town laid out by pinch-penny bankers. And, of course, the winters were frozen and tireless, and the wind hurtled down out of the north like a freight train, and the loss of light would have made anybody demoralized, even the most optimistic souls. In truth, though, Brenner and I never thought of ourselves as being from anywhere in particular. Each time our family moved to a new place, any of the far-flung locales, and settled ourselves into a rented house, and our father put on his pressed blue uniform and drove off to work at some air base, and my mother commenced a new teaching position, Berner and I would try to think that this was where we'd say we were from, if anyone asked. We practiced saying the words to each other on our way to whatever our new school was each time. Hello, we're from Biloxi, Mississippi. Hello, I'm from Oscoda. It's way up in Michigan. Hello, I live in Victorville. I tried to learn the basic things the other boys knew and to talk the way they talked, pick up the slang expressions, walk around as though I felt confident being there and couldn't be surprised. Bernard did the same. Then we'd move away to some other place, and Berner and I would try to get situated all over again. This kind of growing up, I know, can leave you either cast out and adrift, or else it can encourage you to be malleable and dedicated to adjusting, the thing my mother disapproved since she didn't do it, and held out for herself some notion of a different future, more like the one she'd imagined before she met our father. We, my sister and I, were small players in a drama she saw to be relentlessly unfolding. As a result, what I began to care greatly about was school, which was the continual thread in life besides my parents and my sister. I never wanted school to be over. I'd spend as much time inside school as I could, poring over books we were given, being around the teachers, breathing in the school odors, which were the same everywhere and like no other. Knowing things became important to me, no matter what they were. Our mother knew things and appreciated them. I wanted to be like her in that way, since I could keep the things I knew, and they would characterize me as being well-rounded and promising characteristics that were important to me. No matter if I didn't belong in any of those places, I did belong in their schools. I was good at English and history and science and math, subjects my mother was also good at. Each time we picked up and moved, the only fact of life that made moving frightening was that for some reason I wouldn't be allowed to return to school, or I would miss crucial knowledge that could assure my future and was obtainable nowhere else, or that we'd go to some new place where there would be no school for me at all. Guam was once discussed. I feared I'd end up knowing nothing, have nothing to rely on that could distinguish me. I'm sure it was all an inheritance from my mother's feelings of an unrewarded life, though it may also have been that the two of them, a swirl in the thickening confusion of their own young lives, not being made for each other, probably not physically desiring each other as they briefly had, becoming gradually only satellites of each other and coming eventually to resent one another without completely realizing it. They didn't offer my sister and me enough to hold on to, which is what parents are supposed to do. However, blaming your parents for your life's difficulties finally leads nowhere.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Richard Ford about his novel, Canada. We'll be right back after a short break to talk about the significance of borders and to hear Richard read another short passage from the book. In the meantime, check out our blog at mtpr.org/twq.
Dell does eventually finish school, not without many, many trials and tribulations along the way. But he becomes a teacher, and although he's been abandoned by his parents because they made choices that sent them to prison, he finds this teaching career and then begins to look at that as abandonment of students. Like this quote, "Teaching is a gesture of serial abandonment."
It's a typo.
Really?
This is a galley of the book, I think, what I'm holding in my hand here.
Mm-hmm.
It got fixed in the proper book.
And what does it really say?
Teaching is an exercise in serial non-abandonment. That's why you read the galleys of your own book. Because I'm just reading along, you know, and I'm getting to the end of my book, and I see this line, and the copy editor had dropped "non" out of that sentence, and my body shuddered, because that's a really significant line in this book, and you were probably quite right to seize upon it, because it would be I think almost enigmatic.
Yeah, I have in my notes. Why would he think that?
He wouldn't. Good. At least it lets me know, if that doesn't seem to make sense. It doesn't make sense. It lets me know that I was leading up to something properly, and that the fact that "non" gets left off of non-abandonment doesn't make sense is in fact enigmatic. Yeah, but that happens in making books, you know, sometimes, which is, again, why you have to read it. I read all these books aloud to my wife, and when I saw that, I leapt up into the air when I saw that, and I was on the phone in about 3 minutes calling Echo Press, saying, you know, you've really, and I made them go through for all the galley copies that they had left, and change it by hand. But you're the only person who's ever asked me that in the year and a half since this book has been published. No one has pointed that out as being slightly puzzling. It wouldn't really, as you were about to ask, make much sense why he would be a teacher as an act of serial abandonment.
Well, glad we cleared that up.
So am I.
Is there a significance to moving Dell across the border from the U.S. into Canada?
Well, whether or not there's a significance, there's a reason for it. And the reason for it was that I started writing this book living in Dutton, Montana, back in 1988. And I was waiting around for the galleys of a book that I had written called Wildlife to come back from the publisher. And it was coming back slowly. And I just rented a little room above a car repair garage and started writing this story. And it, that little story, the little piece of business that I wrote was about a boy being not kidnapped, but made to go across the Canadian border against his will. And somehow that little transit across the border into Canada created in me what Catherine Ann Porter calls a commotion. And I couldn't tell you what was the precise source of that commotion, something that Neruda calls something kicking in my soul. That's rather melodramatic, but commotion is just enough. So I thought, I've got to write a story because I don't have these, none of us have these commotions all the time. And so when you get one and you're a novelist, you think to yourself, well, I've got to get that into a story someplace because this has got some juju attached to it somewhere. So that's what I did. I wanted him, for some reason that I would later invent, to be made to go across that border against his will, because crossing a border was, for me, something quite dramatic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's not like he could just go back. He was only 15.
No, and this has to happen to you in writing novels. You have to get lucky to make some choices that then radiate out through your book, both in literal and metaphorical ways, and provide what my mother used to call stick 'em for the rest of the book. And crossing borders in this book provided me a kind of a literal and metaphorical stick 'em for this book, because I began to see, it's of course completely provisional, but I began to see a lot of the actions in the book in terms of people crossing borders. Neva and Bev cross a border from innocence to, through the agency of misfeasance, to innocence opposites to guilt. Remlinger in the book crosses the border from more or less a kind of innocence to a kind of malevolence. Dell crosses a border from his adolescence to his young manhood. So there are all kinds of these crossings of borders in the book. But I go back to what I said before. Probably in real life, our everyday lives, there are no such things as these crossings of borders. But if a novel can provide a prism whereby you can see life briefly, provisionally, as having borders which you cross or do not cross, borders that you can't ever recross, then you look more closely at life and you have a kind of intelligence about life which you wouldn't have otherwise. And then you close the book and you go back to your life and you take of that book what you can.
Well, those borders probably provide metaphors for lots of discussion.
Yes, they do.
In book groups or writing classes.
I suppose so, and that's fine by me. Right. As long as people understand that novels organize the world in highly provisional ways. I mean, intellectual conceptions like that are neither true nor false. They're either useful or not useful. And I just want this to be useful for whatever brief period of time the reader can entertain it. And then the reader has to go back to her or his chaotic life like the rest of us and take that with him or not.
And wait for you to write the next one.
Well, I'm about to be 70 years old. Don't hold your breath. I've got pheasant hunting to do.
I don't remember where I heard this, but I heard somewhere somebody said that people should stop writing when they got to the age of 40 because they lose their their verve.
Then that person who said that should.
Yeah, right. But I thought about that when I read Canada, because I believe the novel succeeds because you are older than 40, because the narrator was looking back and able to see through a lens that would not have been available to him when he was younger.
It would be nice to believe that age confers depth and that age confers richness. It only does if it does. You know, I don't know that. I just resist that as a formula because I think about a book like Middlesex by Jeff Eugenides, which he wrote in his 40s, It's so nuanced. It's so smart. It's so funny. It's so full of passion. It's so knowing and smart. That would certainly give the lie to any formula that says you have to be old as I am to write a really wonderful book. And you know, Laurie Moore was writing wonderful books when she was in her 30s, and smart books, as smart as they could be. Deb Eisenberg was writing wonderful books in her 40s. So I would resist. I'm happy that my book seems that way. I'm happy I got a chance to write it. But somebody else at a younger age could certainly write a wonderful book.
Yeah, I think I was thinking of an emotional depth. How well this man had come to know himself and his
Well,
parents.
That was just me taking advantage of, at the end of the book, something I had started at the beginning. You know, you write a book from the beginning to the end, and then in the next year you write it from the end to the beginning, and then you write it from the beginning to the end, so that the things that you commence do seem to take a purchase at the book's conclusion.
Well, speaking of beginnings and endings, let's end with the beginning of the book.
All right.
The first paragraph.
First, I'll tell about the robbery our parents committed, then about the murders, which happened later. The robbery is the more important part, since it served to set my and my sister's lives on the courses they eventually followed. Nothing would make complete sense without that being told first. Our parents were the least likely two people in the world to rob a bank. They weren't strange people, not obviously criminals. No one would have thought they were destined to end up the way they did. They were just regular, although, of course, that kind of thinking became null and void the moment they did rob a bank.
How many times have you read that in the last year and a half?
100. It's all right. I never am sorry. I never think to myself, oh, if I'd only spent a little more time writing that, it might be good. No, it's a good one. It's a good opening.
It is.
When I wrote that opening, it took me about a month to write it, because I kept niggling with it. And I would like to write every book in a way that had an opening like that. But for some reason, one can't. And it may have something to do with the fact that if you throw down a gauntlet like that at the beginning of your book, you'd better have some ammo for the rest of the book. And maybe when I've started books in the past, I wasn't sure that the ammo was there. I think the ammo has been there, and I have concentrated really hard in all the books that I've written since 1982 on writing good beginnings to books. They aren't necessarily exactly like that, but writing good beginnings, which do throw down a kind of gauntlet to the reader and say, oh yeah, or I'm going to tell you something now.
Richard Ford lives in Maine and hunts pheasants in eastern Montana. There's more information about him at our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq. Also there, a link to audio, so you can listen again or share this program with a friend, and links to the Right Questions podcast and Facebook page. Thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.